Warning, you are about to listen to the greatest radio show ever. And due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics. And due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. Now live from the heart of liberal Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning, welcome to the Devil's Advocate Show. Best friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Now here are your hosts, Dom and Crute.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Dominic, we slide into hour two with a fine guest. He is James Santel, former U.S. attorney, hopefully current friend of the Devil's Advocates. He answered our call again. We appreciate you doing so. Hey, Jim. Welcome back, sir.
Always current, always glad to be with you.
Dominic, we'll get to Dominic, perhaps. But Jim, wanted to start with a couple of the topics Dominic and I have found to be, let's call them the lead this week. And sort of off topic, but Jim, this amicus brief, 228 Republicans have signed off on in support of a Mississippi law that's making its way apparently to the U.S. Supreme Court that would ban abortion after 15 weeks. And I see mathematically that's a hell of a lot of Republicans relative to the entire caucus. But Jim, how disruptive would this be to the American people, to reproductive health, to state law, federal law, if Roe v. Wade is either massively undermined or thrown out altogether?
This is very dramatic. I was doing some recent teaching on some of the things coming up before the Supreme Court. This is one of the two major cases that Americans need to be much focused on in the fall and probably we'll be talking about next year at this time. This does come out of exactly the lawsuit that you've identified there, where we've got an attempt to roll back Wade, Roe versus Wade, if you will. Harry Blackmun, as we know, wrote this back in 1973, talked about the viability of the fetus outside of the womb, very much a medical Supreme Court case, but identifying the circumstances under which states can and cannot regulate access to reproductive rights. And that has remained the law since 1973. This is a full frontal assault on Roe versus Wade. It'll be fascinating to see what the Supreme Court does in its present constitution, because obviously it can do one of two or three things. It can, I suppose, as it has done in other cases, find some way of skirting the issue, which would not be an entirely bad thing. They've identified standing and other sort of sometimes called technical. But this also affords them the opportunity to go back to Harry Blackmun, 1973, and revisit Roe versus Wade and determine whether or not the decision premised upon the trimesters of pregnancy should, in fact, that analysis should, in fact, be discarded. And in fact, that there should be, find that there is not a privacy right in the United States Constitution. And the impact, the practical impact of that, if Roe versus Wade is overturned on this case or any other case coming up, and in the future is that this, all this goes back to the states. And the states can then issue, legislate, governors sign off on the legislation, abortion laws as they see fit, because the federal government, by virtue of a rescission of Roe, if that happens, would no longer be the compelling rule of the land. A dramatic change in the not only the landscape of America, but personal privacy rights of women, and I would offer men as well, with respect to reproductive rights in America.
Jim, five Wisconsin Republican congressional members, that's all of them, plus U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, they're all signees on this amicus brief. They all have the same intent. They're showing their colors. They would like to take away Roe v. Wade. They'd like to take away women's choice over their own bodies. Jim, I know you're not an overly political creature, at least not on the radio, but I'm going to ask you to tell me, sir, I mean, politically speaking, if Republicans show their colors in this regard, they're all up. Every single one of these congressional Republicans are on the ballot next year, Jim. Do you think there'll be electoral consequence?
You know, you would certainly think so. And again, I think your question is a really important one, not just because of the political aspect of it, but also this intersection, if you will, the importance of what this brief says. You've got legislatures who are now entering the judicial field, which they can do. There's nothing wrong with an amicus brief, but saying that legally, constitutionally, our United States Constitution does not, in fact, embrace this notion of privacy. And I would like to think that the voters in America and Wisconsin around the country would look at that and say, not only does that overturn a whole line of cases, there's a case called Griswold versus Connecticut, had to do with contraceptive rights, where the whole idea of privacy rights came in. That has been the law of this land for as long as most of us have been alive. And because of the significance of this brief, basically saying, roll all that back. We're, again, looking to a time when America was not as open and affording of rights as it is today. This kind of thing should be the sort of thing that should be looked at by every voter who goes to the polls in Wisconsin or around the country to determine whether or not that's the future of America that they want. Not only by and understand, too, that by voting, whether it's in the state system and the federal system, you can, in fact, have an impact upon these privacy rights. And again, not just the rescission of Roe, if that happens, but many other things out there could fall in the wake of this kind of advocacy presented by this amicus brief.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Our pal James Santel, former U.S. attorney, joining us via the Zoom. Jim, always a pleasure when you come around. Appreciate it, man. Finally, this week, we saw the committee hearing, the select committee put together by Speaker Pelosi to investigate the goings-on on January 6th. Jim, before we get to any of the details and the circumstances and the reaction to it, I want to get your thoughts. Did you happen to see it, and what was your takeaway?
I did, and riveting, and make the recommendation to anyone who has not seen, at least listen to some of the takes on that, the snippets of very compelling testimony from these four officers. Not surprisingly, I've got notes. I've got many, many notes on this. I've got three or four big takes. One is, as in all things, the personalities come through. This notion of bringing alive what we have seen on tape, as horrific as that is, brought alive because of the human stories, this humanity of four officers of the highest order, protecting the Capitol, protecting individuals in our House and our Senate, who again are alive today because of what they did. That personal involvement, that came through loudly and clearly. That's number one. Number two, one thinks back to impeachment, which, yes, was just earlier this calendar year. And with all due respect to the wonderful presentation made by the advocates for the impeachment of the president post his departure from the White House, this is the kind of testimony that, again, could have been presented, presumably, in that situation to bring this all alive. This is not just a matter of breaking windows and violating rope lines. And no, it wasn't about tourists, and it wasn't about people simply expressing their First Amendment rights. This, and it was not just a riot. This was an insurrection. So that comes through as well. The other thing that I take away from this very compelling, heart-wrenching stories is the way in which all of these officers, all four of them, described the various fronts on which they were fighting, quite literally. I suspect many of your listeners, if not all of them, have been to the United States Capitol. As one of them describes being dragged through one of the hallways, you can envision exactly where that was, and you see the threat to them, the threat to our nation, the threat to members of Congress, and it brings all of that war that was going on, that battle that was happening that day, much alive. The final thing I'll say, and then take more questions on this as well, is the use of language. I'm not going to repeat it here, but I was stricken by how appropriate it was for some of our cable news networks to play in its actual recitation by Officer Harry Dunn of what was said to him. Describing the epithet to use to describe him began with a word right in front of it that begins with an F. And again, I won't describe it here other than to say that I think it was a very important thing for America to hear that, for people to understand who it was who was not just rioting, but attempting to undermine our government on that day. They truly are the kinds of people who should be prosecuted as we go forward in all of this. And I was glad to see it and horrified to see it at the same time, because when we talk about the N-word in America, what do? We clean it up. We make it neat. We make it clinical. We make it medical. We make it academic. And it is not. It joins its rightful place in the dung heap of words. We describe people who have disabilities, people who are Irish, people who are Italian, people who are gay and lesbian, and all sorts of other things. It is good for America sometimes to hear the crassness, the horror of those words, to understand who the people who say them really are.
We call them the Trump terrorists, Jim. Let me ask you this. This is a bipartisan committee, although if you ask certain Republicans, they would probably disagree with us. Liz Cheney had the opportunity to speak after Chair Benny Thompson had his opening remarks. And she specifically stated wanting to know what was going on in the White House minute by minute. Of course, Jim Jordan and Banks not allowed on this committee. Jim Jordan asked by Brett Baer on Fox News, I believe it was yesterday or the day before, did you talk to the president on that day? And after a bunch of, yimmer and yammer, and he essentially said yes. And then we hear perhaps subpoenas starting to get issued or at least being considered. Jim, and that's really what I want to get to now. What kind of effort? We look at the Don McGahn, former White House counsel, took 2 years to get his testimony. If this committee wants to hear from Jim Jordan, or this committee wants to hear why Mo Brooks, who apparently yesterday admitted to wearing body armor when he was giving his quote-unquote speech at the insurrection, if they want to get these folks under oath in front of the committee, hell, even the former president of the United States, perhaps his children who were involved, apparently, as reported, in discussing the effects of what was going on that day, how difficult is it going to be for this committee to enforce those subpoenas, Jim?
And again, you indicated we've got some history on this. It has been difficult. The Don McGahn circumstance, as we've talked about at great length, is certainly illustrative. Note there's another important news item that came out this week. I think much related to that, although not specifically related to this particular select committee, but the United States Department of Justice, through a memorandum from the Deputy Attorney General's office, said that because of the extraordinary circumstances, their words, not mine, that weigh against the normal constraints on closely held information, the United States Department of Justice is in fact permitting, authorizing members, both present and former, of the Department of Justice to testify in these kinds of cases. And so that is a good sign that, in fact, we've got people at that level saying we need to have these folks come forward in response to subpoenas and other kinds of requests.
Jim, you going to stick around for another segment?
Excellent, absolutely.
Excellent. Merrick Garland, man, he's slowly working his way back into my heart. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, going to stick around for one more segment. Jim, we certainly appreciate it. Come back, the Devil's Advocates, and James Santel, former U.S. attorney.
The mood of the crowd was positive and festive.
Wrong!
The Devil's Advocates, radio for the 99%.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, sticking around for one more segment. Jim, thank you for doing so. Talking about this committee, and my question ultimately, Jim, the subpoenas that will obviously be coming forward. What legal strategy do you think people like Mo Brooks or Jim Jordan or, hell, even the former President Trump would they use to delay or try to not show up? And what enforcement does this committee have to make them comply?
Sure. We're going to see that again, right? We've got a promise that this select committee is going to reconvene in a couple of weeks. And follow up on your comment before the break about Liz Cheney wanting to get to the bottom of not just what happened on that day, but what was going on at the White House, these communications between Congress and the White House. How do you get that? You issue subpoenas, and you issue them far and wide. You issue them to former Trump officials. You issue them to the former president of the United States of America. He's plainly a fact witness in this matter. You issue them to members of Congress who themselves are fact witnesses, as they indicated. And then we go ahead with what was anticipated to be the litigation about them. You run into court, very likely, not the committee members, but those who are opposing those subpoenas. And you ask to have them quashed as an overreach of the congressional oversight and legislative purpose. And again, you hope that a federal judge will take a look at those kinds of things, act promptly. There's no specific deadline on this select committee's work, but act promptly to ensure that in fact there is a decision made. And you'd like to think an appeals court will also act reasonably promptly. Certainly the Don McGahn circumstance was not a good illustration of that. But given the fact that this is now underway, you've got a standing committee that does have a designed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives to investigate this. You've got a legitimate legislative purpose. You've got an oversight function. It is right within the four corners of the Constitution, and it is being pursued, if the first day is any indication, with all of the balance, almost all the balance, as you would in a trial court, where you're asking people questions about what happened. What did you see? What happened after that? Who, what, where, when, why, and how? Those are the kinds of things that subpoenas are intended to produce a witness who will provide those kinds of testimony. And I would certainly hope that the committee would be aggressive, not only in issuing those subpoenas broadly to get to Liz Cheney's questions, but also to be just as effective and just as forceful in arguing to support those in what should be an expedited adjudication of them by the federal courts right there in D.C.
Our fine guests, James Santel, former U.S. attorney. Jim, you know, someday soon it's going to be Merrick Garland's day. But let me ask you, the big lie, obviously, it's still being told. And right here in the state of Wisconsin, we've got Janelle Brantgen, a Republican state assembly lawmaker who heads up the elections committee. And she's claiming she's going to roll out some sort of forensic audit. And the speaker of the assembly says, slow down. I'm already doing a forensic audit through outside investigators and a former, my words, corrupted Wisconsin Supreme Court justice. But I see Merrick Garland from over at the DOJ says, slow down, states. Your efforts of this sort are going to subject you to what, Jim? What is the DOJ warning the states or these perpetrators of the big lie? What can the DOJ do to, you know, clear the record or at least prevent these ludicrous fraudits?
Right. Once again, this week from 9th in Pennsylvania, which is where Merrick Garland spends his days these days, we get two memorandums. One of them basically says that we're going to still pursue those states out there that are rolling back their COVID rules and restrictions on voting. We're going to address those under the Voting Rights Act. We're going to address those kinds of attempts to suppress the vote. And second, to your very good point, Merrick Garland issues a supplemental memorandum or a second piece, kind of the partner to this, and notes that in recent months, a number of jurisdictions around the United States have taken the unusual second round of examining what has been conducted or proposed in these examinations. He describes them as audits with quotes around them, and says sometimes those may be in compliance with state law, sometimes they are not. Perhaps they're in compliance with federal law, perhaps they're not. And like the first memorandum, promises that the Department of Justice will enforce federal law, which is what he can do, cannot enforce state law, but enforce federal law to ensure that these so-called audits, which again he puts in quotes, do not in fact go forward, do not in fact undermine the legitimacy of the count of the, generally of the election, which has now long been settled. And how do you do that? Well, he's basically promising by this second memorandum, again, to run into federal court and to seek to perhaps enjoin future audits of this kind, whether it's in Wisconsin, other places around the country, to stop them, as we've seen in Arizona, from affecting the legitimacy of the mechanisms themselves, doing those other things to ensure that the voting rights of Americans are upheld and the legitimacy of the results of those elections are not overturned by what he says it very, very gently and very diplomatically, but really are fraudulent efforts to do something to undermine this larger purpose, which is to ensure that Americans can vote and their votes are counted.
My greatest fear, Jim, is that domestic terrorism has been inspired by this big lie. We saw it on January 6th. I believe it was Officer Hodges that defined terrorism in the statutes, domestic terrorism. We've taken to calling them the Trump terrorist. Jim, if this is allowed to continue, be it here in the state of Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, wherever, do you fear future domestic terrorism and more violence?
Yes, period. You know, there are many people who say that January 6th was the rehearsal, and that makes it perhaps a little bit too flip. But this is serious. The fact that one of the folks who was charged out of January 6th it was discovered even since that time with more weapons. That came out this week as well, and obviously he's getting his status revoked here. We have got a very serious problem here. It's a federal problem, it's a state problem, it's a local problem, and it goes not only to law enforcement, but also about the way that people talk about America. And again, we can disagree on policy, we can disagree on what to do, but this notion that we can once again make up our own facts about what happened, and for that reason, advance and undermining of our basic institutions, including the Constitution, that is very, very scary.
Former U.S. Attorney James Santel, our fine guest. Thank you so much, Jim. The rest of you, come back with us. More Devil's Evidence.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care.
Our cruisers can't repel
legislation of this magnitude.